Morning. It's a delight to be here at my alma mater. My one challenge is going to be being able to see my notes. I'm in the middle of a glasses change, and I don't have all that settled yet, but I can see you, and that's the most important thing. This chapel has a great deal of meaning to Rebecca and me. Actually, we met in 1963, I believe, at the Wilmore Methodist Church. We were both staying after. There was an altar full of people, and we've always been front row folks, and we were up front and praying for people at the altar. And the people between us had gotten up and left. The evening was getting a little late, and I looked to my left, and here was this vision. We'd been on campus together, and we hadn't met, hadn't seen one another, and she had a kind of a silky blouse with a bow that was made out of the same fabric as the blouse and the bouffant hairstyle of the 60s and black skirt and the pointy toes. And she had her legs crossed, her hands over her knees, her head raised, her eyes closed in prayer. And as soon as I saw her, I knew she was going to be my wife. And I told her so within the next few days. The fact that she... The fact that she was engaged to the fellow she dated through high school, who had been the captain of the football team, didn't seem to be a particular problem to me. We married between our junior and senior year and came across this platform as husband and wife. We've got those pictures. Asbury was very formative for both of us. As a Canadian, my parents were European. Dad was born in London. His family had a great deal of conflict, religious conflict. His mother was from a French Huguenot family. His father was from a Catholic family. And the reason for their emigrating to Canada was to get away from the religious difficulty. So when they came to Canada, they came with the determination that they would never again engage in anything religious. They'd never again darken the door of a religious institution or a church. And that was the environment in which I was reared. And it wasn't just my family environment. Of course, it was all of their friends and our broader family. It was devoid of any kind of spiritual dimension. God wasn't discussed. His name wasn't mentioned. I don't believe that there was any animosity. It was just keep a distance. And in that context, I went to Peter, Paul, and Mary concert. Do you remember some of, well, no, you wouldn't. Some of you might. Do you know the name, Peter, Paul, and Mary? Or that's ancient history, too. Anyway, it was a folk concert. And again, I was up as close to the front as I could get. And in that setting, in a very secular setting, I had my first encounter with God. And I don't even know how to describe it. I don't think I would describe it as a mystical experience. But however he did it, he was there. I knew he was there. And what he was communicating to me was, Paul, you cannot ignore me any longer. And scared the willy out of me. Really, really frightened me. And the thing that frightened me, actually, was the fact that implicitly, the only thing I knew about God was that He was bigger than me. And I wasn't at a place where I wanted anybody to run my life or dominate my life or make my decisions for me. So my response was just really to kick back. But eventually I said, all right, God, I have no idea what I'm getting into. That was one of the truest comments I have ever made in my life. I have no idea, but I'm opening my life to you. And being a biblical illiterate, and Jesus was a bearded guy who walked around in sandals 2,000 years ago. I had heard someplace that he died on a cross, but for what reason, I had no idea. And in that first encounter, it really was an encounter with God. And I said, all right, I'm opening my life to you. But there was implicit in that a sense of subordination, because I figured that if he was the larger of the two of us, then he would be the dominant factor. Well, I went back home and found a Bible. How a Bible got into our home, I have no idea. It was in the back underneath in a shelf in the library, and I found it. It was an old American Standard, I believe. I still have that Bible at home. And I started reading it, and it was so alive. Thankfully, I didn't start in Ecclesiastes, or I started in Matthew. That was a gift from God. I started in Matthew, and I read it like a textbook. I didn't know any other way to read it. I underlined it. I still have it. My kids are fighting over who's going to inherit it when I pass on. It was so alive, and it was out of reading the Gospels that Jesus emerged, and I realized that Jesus had come representing the Father, coming out of the Father's love and care, commissioned to redeem us and to reveal the Father to us. You know, Jesus was saying, this is what God's like. He wanted us to know. The Father wanted us to know who he was, and in Jesus he revealed himself. So shortly after that experience, I talked to my friends, and they said, cool, man, but none of them were interested. I couldn't find anybody that reciprocated interest. I made a decision to visit a couple of churches and talk to the pastors and ask them if I could participate in their congregation. And the first pastor I went to listened to my story. And I don't know what words I used at that time, but they weren't religious words. And he said, he listened, and I watched him back up a bit. And he said, well, Mr. Petrie, you may not come to our church. And what did I know? You know, I said, okay. So I went and interviewed with another pastor, and this was a Methodist pastor in the Woolworth Memorial Methodist Church. It was a church that Woolworth, this predates most of you as well. It was he had a chain of stores, and he built this church. That's why it's Woolworth Memorial. And talked to the pastor, and the pastor said, well, Mr. Petrie, you can come to my congregation on the basis of you, if you promise me, however he phrased it, not to tell anybody in my congregation about your experience. I said, okay. It'd be hard to realize how out of the whole church picture I was. I didn't feel badly. I didn't feel hurt. I didn't feel dejected, or I just didn't. I didn't know how these things ran. So I started going, and in the meantime, I was finishing secondary school, finishing high school, and I got accepted to Columbia on a full academic ride. So I was headed there. And one Sunday in that little Methodist church, they had an exchange program. In those days, I'm not sure what happens today. Once a year, pastors would exchange pulpits. And the fellow who came on that Sunday had some vitality, some spiritual vitality. I appreciated what he said. I don't now remember what it was, but I do remember that there was a dynamic. And as I left, we were standing in the foyer of this church, and he started questioning me and what was I going to do next, and I told him where I was planning on going, but I said to him, but I don't feel settled about it. And that was a gift from God, I think, because I didn't know what it meant to be led by the Holy Spirit. I didn't understand that God had a plan particularly for us, but I said, I don't feel settled about it. And he said, well, have you ever thought about Asbury College? I said, I've never heard of Asbury College. He said, it's in Wilmore, Kentucky. Shook my hand, walked out the door. That afternoon, I wrote a letter. In those days, all we had to do was put Asbury College, Wilmore, Kentucky, asking for an application. And I received an acceptance. And got on, worked the summer at a yacht and country club, got on a train, headed for Lexington, got off, was picked up by a student, and a new life began for me. As far as I know, and I believe that this is accurate, it's as accurate at least as my memory allows, I never had met an individual who had a personal engagement with God, who knew Jesus, who had spiritual inclinations like that. So I got dropped down here with all these kids and professors and who were, many of whom were enthralled with Jesus, and it was great. I did have a bit of a difficulty with the culture down here. I'll leave it at that. Some of you who graduated with me remember some of those difficulties. But they were wonderful years. You know, I met my wife. I met her 3 weeks after a missions conference. It was an Indian evangelist of some repute whose name I can't now remember, but he was great. And it was at the Methodist Church. And both Rebecca and I went to the altar that night to commit our lives to missions. And a couple of years after that, I was president of the Mission Society, went back through and pulled our cards. They weren't cards then, it was just a piece of paper on which we had written what we thought God was asking us to do. And it's almost identical. Almost, when I pulled them, and we have them in our files, in our possession now. So our call to missions, Rebecca and I meeting one another, growing in an awareness of God. She came from a Methodist background, but it was a very liberal Methodist background. There wasn't a lot of spiritual vitality. So we grew here. We got to know Jesus more deeply. We began to establish the disciplines of early morning quiet time and the people here in those days. This is nearly 50 years ago now. Dennis Kinlaw was a prof at the seminary, and he was completing his doctor's thesis, and we got to meet one another, and he very graciously asked me to meet with him once a week for prayer. So for well over a year, maybe 2 years, I'd go over once a week and have the privilege of praying together with him. David Siemens was the pastor here at the Methodist Church at that point, and his presence and impact on our lives were strong. We could go through a list of people, not just those that were in leadership and administrative leadership, but other fellow students with whom we shared a common commitment. Then in 1965, forgive all this personal reflection, but I felt what I want to say this morning is probably going to be best founded, and I've got to get going here, on some of these personal reflections. 1965, a group of us, we call ourselves 16 singing men, stood on a platform here, and we had a female trio, and we did a Thanksgiving concert, and we recorded it. In those days, it was reel to reel, and I took the recording back to alumni. I was in alumni dorm, and I was listening to it for its musical content, for the technical content, because we were talking at that point about doing a recording. And the final song that we sang from back here was, "If you'll take one look at the Savior today, you'll see his arms open wide." I don't have the voice today that I did then. "Time after time he's waited before, now he is waiting again." And in that moment, in that dorm room, I can see it as if it was yesterday, the presence of the Lord was so strong, and I felt that where I had sung it as an invitation, he was saying it to me. And I was confused, because I was a committed believer, going into ministry, committed to missions, and time after time he's waited before. And what he communicated to me at that moment, he said, "Paul, you don't love me." Well, I got real defensive. I said, "Of course I do." And I ran through the stuff that I was doing and where we were headed, and it just kind of dribbled off my lip. And I finally said, "Well, why don't I love you?" And he said, "You don't know me." And that was the end of that encounter, but that was a pivotal changing point in my life. And I started praying, "Lord, give me a desperate and unsatiable hunger to know you until I love you with everything in me and until everything that I say, do, and think is born out of that love." And that's a prayer I still pray today, though probably for 30 years, I prayed it every morning, and I've given it as a gift to our children. So the centrality of what we have to offer to the world, what we have to offer to our friends, to our families, the redemptive dynamic that we represent to a world that's in great need is a relationship with the Father through the Son. We're not principally propounding an experience. I've worked with a lot of political leaders in Europe, heads of state, heads of government, those that are in members of royal families. And when we began this 15 years ago, I made a decision that I was never going to talk to anybody about getting saved. I was not going to use that term, because I wanted them to come in a subordinate fashion and give themselves to Jesus as his followers, and not think that there can be a step in between. I believe in salvation. There's no question about that. But God made him Lord and Redeemer. The Father made him Lord. And I think it's unbiblical to believe that we can put salvation in our back pocket and then go about doing life the way we wish to do it. We come and we bow, we give ourselves to him, and he redeems us. So it's been on that basis. We do an annual prayer breakfast in Brussels, as was mentioned. We're limited by the size of the dining room. We have about 350 people who come. Many of those are European parliamentarians from the European Parliament. Many of those are parliamentarians that come from other parliaments in Europe. In fact, there are now 14 parliamentary prayer groups in other national capitals in Europe. A lot of heads of state and government have come. I forget, somebody with whom we prayed this morning is going to Europe and going to start in Liechtenstein. Prince Nicholas von Liechtenstein from Luxembourg is a very good friend and has been deeply involved in this from the beginning. And the invitation is to a gathering around the person of Jesus. That's the formal invitation that goes out to heads of state and heads of government and parliamentarians and cabinet ministers to gather around him. Now, we do have experiences along the way, but the experiences aren't the end. They're not even the goal. The goal, do you remember when Jesus was asked, what's most important to God? Now, it was supposed to be a trick question, but they came to him, and he gave a clear he didn't give a trick answer. What's the greatest commandment? What is God's highest priority? What is his deepest desire? What does he want from every man and woman? What is his highest priority? And Jesus said that you love him with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength, being captivated by who he is. Now, he could have said his goal is that you serve him, because that's important, very important. He could have said his goal is that you trust him, or believe him, even follow him. All good things. But that isn't what he said. He said the deepest desire, purpose, anticipation in the Father's heart is a relational anticipation that you know him and love him until everything that flows out of your life is born out of that communion with and fellowship with and integration with the Father and with his Son. And then, of course, he went on and said that the second commandment is like it, that you love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now, what grew in those years for me was that God is fundamentally a relational God. He is a sweet society in and of himself, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Out of the three in one, out of that sweet society, out of that eternal community, all of creation was born. That's reflected in how each of us is born. I mean, none of us was born from one parent. All of us were a product of a relationship, hopefully a loving relationship. The future is something that's born out of relationship, not out of our own individual activity. So it's vital that as we seek him, we look for the people with whom God is joining us so that our future unfolds out of relationship and out of relationship. And when the scriptures are read in that way, there's a tremendous life-changing power. And we're talking about faith in culture. I've been a missionary. I started a mission organization. Have done lots of evangelism through the years of every type. The most effective instrument to reach at least the people with whom I'm working now isn't a message. It isn't an institution. It isn't even a miracle. It's a relationship. When parliamentarians see some of their peers who have really grown to deeply love one another and share their lives together, it's like a, you know, they want it. They may not be open to a religious, what's the word I want, not system, but they will be open to a relationship. And I've got one more minute. I'll tell you a story. I'm not nearly through what I wrote down yet, but a good friend of ours is a fellow named Vytautas Landsbergis. He was formerly the president of Lithuania. He was the first elected president after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I met him probably 15 years ago at the Council of Europe in Strasbourg. We became good friends. And this is his story. He grew up as an atheist in Lithuania. After the fall of the Soviet Union, he was elected as president, and he went to Greece on a political political journey. And while he was in Greece, the folks from whomever he was meeting, I'm sure it was, since he was president, he would have had to have been meeting with some of the higher level leaders in Greece. They took him to Ephesus on a little sightseeing tour. And they took him to the home where Mary, Jesus' mother, was supposed to have lived the last of her years under John's care. And so he went in as a tourist and heard the story and was so struck. You know what he was struck by? That in the hour of Jesus' greatest pain and challenge, greatest loss and crisis, he said, "Mom, John's going to take care of you. John, take care of my mother." That was like it was a revelation to Vytautas. And he went out of that room almost shaking. Within 6 weeks, he had made a deep commitment to Jesus, to become a follower of Jesus, because he saw love between him and his mom and his friend. Now, that's a revelation of his love in the midst of crisis and pain. But it's the same dynamic. If we are called to represent Jesus and his kingdom, the thing we need to prioritize in our own lives is to learn to love the Father. And we make a decision, but that decision starts a process. It isn't all done the moment you say, "All right, God, I love you with all my heart and mind, soul and strength. What's next? Father, I want to love you with every fiber of my being. I want to know you. I want your life to be revealed through mine." And then he begins the journey of revealing himself ever more deeply, and loving him is a consequence of knowing him more deeply. But how can you not love him when you know him? And then he leads us to the people with whom we're to share our lives deeply, and out of that community, his testimony. Do you remember what Jesus said when he upped the ante a bit in John? He said, "I'm going to leave you one new commandment. It's like the old one, but I want you to love one another the way I have loved you. If you do that, the world will know that the Father sent me." Everything else that we do may be good and great, and I've done a lot of things and am doing a lot of things and want to do a lot of things, but the testimony that convinces is something that's born out of relationship. So, I would like to say some more. I won't. I shan't. Just seek God and ask Him to help you to know Him. And then ask Him to show you who the people are with whom your life is to be integrated. The end result of that will be a very fruitful life. Thank you.